As we near Christmas, we just want to encourage you today.
I was allowed to go in the police wagon with my mother, and when I had to release her into the synagogue, the only synagogue that was not burned in 1938, it was tough. But I was so grateful that she had become a Christian and that she had the faith. And we knew that even if we were separated by death, that we would someday meet in heaven.
Welcome to Understanding the Times Radio with Jan Markell, radio for the remnant. Today we want to feature a testimony that has blessed millions over the years. Anita Dittman is a Holocaust survivor whose testimony has been heard around the world. It is a story of one miracle after another. We'll talk about that this hour. Here is today's programming.
And welcome to the program. I'm so glad you can join me. And I wanted to do something just a little different this week and special, I hope, as we are heading into Christmas in a few days. I want to air a portion of the Anita Dittman testimony. She is a Holocaust survivor who passed away a few years ago, and I wrote her story in book form. This would have been a few years ago, and WorldNet Daily then made it into a DVD special as well. We have both of those in my online store. The title, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, A Young Jewish Woman Discovers the Messiah's Faithfulness in the Midst of the Holocaust. And many of you now have seen the Bonhoeffer film, Anita and her mother, after they became believers, attended a church aligned with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Many of you met this woman. She spoke in hundreds of churches over the last 30-plus years. She had a Jewish mother and an Aryan father. Anita and her mother survived Nazi Germany miraculously. As I document in the book and the DVD, both became believers in Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, and that strengthened them for their concentration camp experiences. And when the war ended, Anita walked across a section of Europe to find her mother, who had also survived a concentration camp, and she walked great distance on a badly infected leg that left her in searing pain. And this was an incredible journey. So here is Anita, but understand time does not allow me to air her entire story.
It was early in spring of 1939 when we had gone to church. After church, our pastor called us in. He said, Hilda, Anita, and Hella, I have good news for you. For several months, I have been working on getting you out of the country. And I got in touch with a organization in Berlin that would help you to go to England. They would even give part of the money, the rest of it, you had to raise it. We were so happy that finally, maybe we can escape Hitler's tyranny. And I remember I was racing down every day to meet the mailman, racing down the steps to see if that envelope would come. But it wasn't until about the middle of summer, about June of 1939, but only my sister's visa arrived. We got my sister ready, time marched on, and it was August 31st, 1939, and we escorted my sister to the railroad station where she would begin her journey by train through Holland and then finally on to England by boat. And we reassured her that any day our visas would come. Well, on September, which was the next day, the borders were closed, no traffic was allowed out of the country, no foreign mail was allowed out of the country, and my mother and I knew we were trapped in Hitler's hell. We knew what was laying ahead of us, but we had Christ in our life. And that really, really gave us the strength. And I remember our pastor often saying to us, Hilda and Anita, even if death is the ultimate for you, death is but the door to eternal life. Hold on to your faith. I was about 15 years old when the principal was walking into my schoolroom and he said, Dittman, meet me out in the hall, pick up your things. And I packed up all my stuff and met him out there, and he handed me a writing from the Gestapo notifying me that due to my Jewish heritage, I was permanently suspended from school. And he added to it, and he said, it's high time that the German government is going to cleanse our school system of riffraff such as yourself. I was home for just a few months. So in October, November, I was drafted into we worked in a canning factory. And I was always very athletic, and I think it showed. So the boss made me carry 100 pounds by myself. And I remember some days I did that 24 times. Well, no matter how hard we worked, no matter how cold we were sometimes, and I know how many bed bugs bit at night, it didn't matter. We were still free. In the meantime, three of my mother's older sisters moved in with us. So there was a lot of squabbling about the fact that my mother had become a Christian. Little by little, here and there, day after day, more and more people went to the camps. And many, many times there would be that knock at the front door. And one aunt after another was taken. And they were older, and I felt so bad that we knew we would never see them again. When it was lunch break over at the factory, and it was the same for us in the office, I went over into the Jewish locker room where my mother was and was going to have lunch with her. And I did this for a while, and all of a sudden, my boss, he was just furious. He says, "I will not permit you to go to the Jewish locker room." I said, "Well, why?" "Because I say so." He said, "You don't belong there." I said, "Well, where do I eat? The Aryans, your people, they don't want me. And if I can't be with my mother," I said, "they're my people. And if it bothers you so much, then I want to go over to the cold factory and work there." And then he took his fist and he pounded on the table and he said, you listen to me. I tell you, you can't be it in the Jewish room. I will, if you don't listen, I will report you to the Gestapo." I put my fist on the table and said, "Okay, tell the Gestapo." And I said, "You can't force me not to be with my own mother." He left me alone after that. In fact, he showed more respect to me. He stopped flirting with me and showed more respect to me afterwards. I had a lovely friend, and he and his parents resided in a room right next to ours, my mother's and mine. And we became fast friends. We were both 14. He was a couple of months younger than I. And we had a lovely friendship. And the nice thing was, in those days, kids weren't that sex-minded that early. We had a lovely friendship. Sometimes I would wash dishes and he would dry dishes. And I looked up one time and he smiled at me and he was beautiful. He had black curly hair, looked very Jewish. But somehow, whenever I would mention Christ, he'd freeze. And so one day I was very disturbed. I went to my pastor and I said, "Pastor Hornish, I think I'm a coward." And he said, "Tell me about this." And he said, "Anita, you know, sometimes we Christians have a tendency to talk and to preach a little bit too much. Sometimes we can turn people off with that. Pray for him and pray for the Holy Spirit to work in him, and just show him your love, and then let him know also what Christ has done for you." Well, unfortunately, one day there was a knock at the door. I found out that the Gestapo had come to pick him up, and I couldn't even say goodbye to him. I was just beside myself. After school, I didn't go home, and I went straight to the synagogue where the people were gathered, and one of the German Nazi guards caught me in time. He says, "What's the pretty blonde Aryan girl doing?" And I said, "I just want to say goodbye to a friend of mine in there, and do you want to tell him that I love him?" "Well," he said, "we don't have time for silly sentimentalities." I said, "It's not a sentimentality. You know, I want to tell him that Jesus loves him too." "Well, they don't need to hear that, you know." I said, "Yeah, they do." "Well," he said, "I tell you what, it's Christmas soon, and I'm going to let you go in there, but don't stay long." So when I went in there and Joachim spotted me, he says, "Are you out of your mind? They could lock you up and take you along." I said, "Okay, fine, then we can be together." "No," he said, "your mother would be very sad. You better go." And so he gave me a hug and he kissed me on the forehead. And he said, "I love you, Anita." I said, "And I love you too, and Jesus loves you too." And when I was telling my mother that, she said, "You're crazy. You know, they could have locked you up." I said, "But mother, they didn't. I needed to tell him not only that I loved him, but that Jesus loves him too." I said, "Who knows that in dark hours he may have thought about it. I had a strange dream, and there was a huge body of water, and in the near distance was an ocean liner packed with people, and they all seemed to look alike, and they're all waving to us. And I turned around, my mother was standing right next to me, and I turned around to look at my hat box, and when I turned around, my mother was gone, and she was on the boat too. On December 24th, in the holy night, that I had that dream, and on the 7th of January, the Gestapo came, and these two men in heavy boots marched in, as we had seen it so many times. They grabbed my mother by the collar, pushed her back into the room, and sat her down and gave her a form to fill out. They put red labels on everything. And except not on my bed and not on my clothes, but everything was labeled with a sticker of red. And they informed me that the next day they would come from the Gestapo headquarters and they would pick up every item. The only thing I was allowed was a plate and a few forks and spoons, and my bed and my very personal belongings and my clothes. And if I wanted anything back, I had to purchase it back at greatly inflated prices. I was allowed to go in the police wagon with my mother, and when I had to release her into the synagogue, the only synagogue that was not burned in 1938, it was tough. But I was so grateful that she had become a Christian and that she had the faith. And we knew that even if we were separated by death, that we would someday meet in heaven.
If you just joined me, you're hearing the testimony of Holocaust survivor Anita Dittman. Wrote her book some years ago. Find the book and DVD in my online store, olivetreeviews.org, olivetreeviews.org, and go to our online store.
There were lots of people that I had met before, especially my childhood friend Steffi. Her mother was picked up, the Wolf brothers. And so we decided we want to see our mothers one more time. And I had here my mother's bathrobe that she had forgotten and some sandwiches that Pastor Horney's wife had fixed. And I thought, we've got to smuggle us in there and see that somebody would deliver it to her. And we found a tunnel there. And this section of the synagogue had been remodeled into a hotel. And while one of the oldest of the brothers, of the Wolf brothers, was kind of occupying the clerk, the rest of us sneaked down into the tunnel. And we got to the end of the tunnel, and the door between the tunnel and where they had the Jewish people, there was movement. We stuck our head in there, but there was a guard in there, so we waited until the guard would leave. And then we said to an older lady, and I whispered to her, "Give this to Hilda Dittman." And the other said, "And please," and they all named, because the woman probably wouldn't remember their mothers. But while we were ready to go back out, one of the Gestapo officials had found out what we were doing. And so they took us and brought us before the head of the Gestapo. Well, they accused us that we were trying to free prisoners, and that was death penalty. And Steffi broke down, and I said, "We're not trying to free anybody." I said, "My mother had forgotten her bathrobe, and so I brought her her bathrobe so she'd have a bathrobe." And I said, I couldn't see her. I couldn't go in the front door. They wouldn't let us. So then I had to find a way to get that bathrobe to my mother. So then they went into another room and conferred, and we were still lined up against the wall. And then I have a feeling there was one other official that my friend and I had done something nice for him, and I think that Mr. Hampel probably said, "Let them go. They weren't doing anything." And I found out that she was in Camp Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia. I went on my knees and I said, "Lord, help me, dude. What can I do for my mother?" And then it came to me that I will have to just only eat half the rations and send the other to her. About June 1944, I had a strange feeling one day. "I'm not going to send my mother the bread. I'll go get Zweiback at the bake shop, because they had it freshly made and it is toast. It tastes good too." And I thought to myself, why am I doing this? Is this starvation finally getting to my brains? Why am I doing that? And exactly 10 days later, a card came from my mother. She was allowed to do that. On the card, she thanked me for the zwieback because she had been stricken with dysentery where she could not eat the dark bread. And she had knelt by her cot one night and prayed to God to influence me to send a zwieback. I said, that was another hotline to heaven. 1944, it was the 9th of August that I got a summons in my mail that the next day I had to stand in line at the main railroad station. I was allowed to take either a knapsack or a small suitcase with my necessities, and of course it was still summer. So how was I going to tell my mother? And I thank God that I wasn't just picked up. And I prayed so hard, Lord, show me what I must do. So again, I took off and went to a grocery store that was still open in the evening. And there was this big, nice, dark loaf of pumpernickel with a red label on one end, and it was wrapped in a special wrapper. And so I very carefully opened the wrapper, pulled out the bread, trimmed off the red label so that I could glue it back. And then I made a deep indentation with a knife, rolled up a note, and let my mother know in a very gentle way that I have to go away for a while and for her not to worry about it and everything will be okay. And I wrapped up the bread and I prayed over it. And I said, Lord, please don't let this bread fall into the hands of a Nazi. Stood in line with I think there were about 300 of us, I'm not quite sure. And we were whisked off. We were not in cattle cars, regular train. We didn't know where they were taking us. And then we finally, when we arrived there, it was warm outside. The women were herded into a big cow barn and the men into a large horse stable nearby. About 150 women housed in that cow barn. The toilet facility in the back of it, the building, was an open ditch that had a contraption put over so we could sit there at least. No walls, no privacy, nothing. In the morning hours, about 4 o'clock, we were awakened very harshly. We had to stand in line. We were counted and recounted, and humiliations were hurled at us. And then finally they gave us a cup of imitation coffee and a piece of bread. And we were loaded up with digging equipment, picks, shovels, and spades, and we were marched off. Then when we came to our workplace, we were, of course, told that we were working for the Reich, for the country, and we should feel very honored to work for the Führer. And then the digging started, and we would dig ditches that were ultimately, when they were done, about, I would say, maybe 10 feet deep. And 15 feet wide, every day we would go out there. And it was hot and we were dirty. Ditches we dug were supposed to be tank traps in case the Russians are coming into the country. But Hitler would always say, you know, wir siegen, we're winning. And we were not allowed, while we were digging, we were not allowed to talk, but those of us that were Christians, we couldn't keep our mouths shut. And pretty soon we knew the people that were interested in having Bible readings in the evening, because we still had our Bibles. And that's what we did. After a day's hard work, we stood in line, we marched home, stood in line for our food rations. They ladled some soup, hot soup in there that we never knew what was swimming around in it, very overly salted. The only people that were compassionate were the villagers. They were very nice to us, very nice. The butchers, the baker, and other people, really nice. I think they felt sorry for us. Well, then winter came, and then we were fighting the elements. And the ditches were dug, and now we were working in the forest. The kind of work we were doing, we were cutting trees and so forth. We were no longer in a barn. We were in an old dance hall above a tavern. There were two taverns in the village. We would go out and we would get snowed on, and then we would march home wet, and we did have no place to dry things. And then we'd put the wet clothes on the next day and stand outside in the ice cold air. But we thank God that we were still breathing fresh air, because it was at that point that we were told that as soon as our work was completed, we would be shipped to Auschwitz to be cremated. And one day Christian comes to me, he says, do you know what day it is today? I said, no, what is it? Tell me, I don't have a calendar. I know it must be close to Christmas. Yeah, he said, today is Christmas Eve. And I said, wow. So he said, I got the permission from Mr. Anders that if anybody is interested in going to a church service, of course we will go with a couple of guards who will escort us. It was dark outside, but the moon was out, the stars were out, and the moon was shining on the snow, and it was just like sparkling little diamonds. And from all over the villages, the church bells rang. Hitler couldn't stomp that out. And it was just a concert, a heavenly concert. We were really celebrating Christ. And not only that, we were like Christ. We were sleeping on hay, we were homeless, we were poor, we were hungry. At one point, I was very sick. I was losing weight very rapidly, and I was very weak, so they sent me to sick bay, hoping they could do away with me. And I didn't know that. And next to my bed in sick bay, the sister of one of the other friends that I had, and she had contracted sore joints, so they were probably hoping they can finish her off too. A nurse came in when it was time, I think it was breakfast the next day, and she handed me a little pill. She put it in my mouth, and then she handed me a cup of what they call flour soup. And she gave that for me to drink, and she says, now you drink that pill down. And I did, and I swallowed it. And the nurse was still standing there, and I threw up immediately, and I threw up. And this happened for about almost 3 days. And this gal next to me in bed, she said, why don't you put that pill way up there in your gum and drink a couple of drinks of that soup. And then when she leaves, wait a little while and then go down to the outhouse and dump the stuff and make vomiting noises. I said, good idea. So I did that and I got by with it. And then she said, crawl under the covers. And before they pick up my dishes, I left a bunch of these potatoes with that gravy. It isn't bad. And eat those. And I did. And I started putting on weight. And they couldn't imagine, how can this be? So we were both released then. And so we were loading these on horse-drawn wagons, and he was on one side, I was on the other side, and he had the most beautiful smile and curly brown hair and blue eyes. I mean, he was a darling, and he played the violin and the piano and the organ. Just a lovely person. We got to know each other well, and it was a love that had no so-called what you call romance. There was no time for it, no kissing or anything, and I was much too shy. But it was a beautiful love. And he also got together after Christmas, short before they marched us off. It was about the maybe third week in January that he and other people who were musicians, and I don't know how they got their instruments, met at a Catholic church. A priest in the village was very friendly to us, and he allowed us to use his church because it was bitter cold. They got together and they played the most beautiful music. We were all huddled up in blankets and it was just beautiful. And then about 3 or 4 days later, they marched us off.
When I come back, we will wrap up the Anita Dittmann testimony, in part anyway, story of her remarkable survival during the Nazi World War II, her experiences in a concentration camp, her escape and reunification with her mother in just a minute or two.
We hope you'll stay in touch with us online through olivetreeviews.org. That's olivetreeviews.org. You can call us Central Time at 763-559-4444. That's 763-559-4444. Write us through the mail at Olive Tree Ministries and Jan Markell, Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota, 55311. That's Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota, 55311. In this age of fake news and false teaching, thank you for trusting Understanding the Times Radio and Olive Tree Ministries. As we wind down 2024, we want to thank our Understanding the Times radio audience for your faithful prayer and financial support. We are encouraging people to be watchmen on the wall from coast to coast and around the world on the internet. We have some difficult days ahead. The world is in turmoil politically and spiritually. Few understand the signs of the times. That's why we've been airing now for 23 years on radio and online. We want to encourage you to always look up and await His return. We will chronicle events in the new year, just like this year. He's coming again, perhaps today.
This lady told me that that very morning when I came in the early afternoon, my mother had a chance to go home to Breslau, to my hometown, with some friends and other people. And she refused to go. And she said, if my daughter will come here. She said, and if she has to crawl with her faith and her determination, and even if she has to crawl, she didn't realize there were sometimes times when I had to change trains, that I had to crawl on my hands and knees to get to the next tracks.
We know you can't always be by a radio. So if you miss a program, visit our website, olivetreeviews.org. That's olivetreeviews.org. And then go to radio, where we feature both the audio and video version of our program. You can also catch the program at oneplace.com, on our Rumble or YouTube channel, on all of our social media, and on his channel, Christian TV. Here is Jan Markell to introduce the balance of today's programming.
As we head into Christmas week, I wanted to bring back the true story of Anita Dittmann this hour, Holocaust survivor. I wrote her book years ago, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, A Young Jewish Girl Discovers the Messiah's Faithfulness in the Midst of the Holocaust. World Net Daily made it a powerful film as well. Find both in my online store. The book was published by Tyndale House and more recent years by Lighthouse Trails. And Anita escaped the concentration camp, and that is a story in itself. When the war ended, she walked across Europe, a portion of it anyway, to find her mother, who had also survived the camps. And she walked that great distance on a badly infected leg that left her in terrible pain. It was almost a superhuman accomplishment to do what she did, but she had to find her mother. Much in this hour has been left out to fit into our broadcast time frame here on Understanding the Times Radio, but find the DVD and the book in my online store or give us a call. Back to Anita Dittmann.
On the 23rd of January in the evening, about 10 o'clock, they told us all to stand outside. And it was very dark. There was no light from anywhere and no moon or nothing. So it was very easy for anybody to escape that night. And there were so many of us that they had to watch. Cold and it was wet and the snow was deep, but we didn't know where they were going to take us, whether they're going to send us on a death march or not. So I remember that the Wolf brothers approached me and they said, go with us. We're going to find a place. There's a train going at midnight and it's way after 10 o'clock now. We can make it. Take the train, and we have a place where we will stay overnight in Breslau and wait out the rest of the Nazi era. And I told my friend Hella, I said, let's go for that. And at that time, Christian was already standing beside me and heard this, and he said, no, don't go. You stay with me, both of you. And he begged me, please. And he said, the Lord has laid it upon my shoulders to keep you from going. And of course, I was madly in love with him. And I said, okay, and I'm glad he said that because I wouldn't be here if I would have gone with the Wolf brothers, because they were caught, they were picked up and put into a district very short where I grew up, in that little suburb where we lived. The bomb was dropped and they were all killed. And we trotted through very heavy snow and we walked all through the night. And then we came to another camp, but then one night we decided, let's leave. Let's run for it. So we did. It was dark outside, and then the Hella and Christian, his sister and I, and another couple, we made it for it. We went through, it was a dark, dark, overcast, slightly snowy evening, and we made it through a forest. It was a deep forest. And we thought we weren't seen, and we weren't seen, because we went through another deep forest, long ways from our camp. We were exhausted, we were tired, we were hungry, but we said we can't just stay, we have to try. So we went through very deep snow, and sometimes we would fall and Christian would pick us up again, and we heard a noise. It was a farmer with a horse and wagon, and the wagon was filled with feed sacks, whatever. So he said, "Where are you going?" We said, "Well, wherever you're going, we'll go." And sure enough, he left us off at the next town. A lot of people had gone to the west, evacuated, and the apartments were wide open. It was dark outside, and so we said, "Lord, show us if there's a place. Have you got a place for us, Lord?" And sure enough, when we went to that one house, it looked like deserted. And there we stayed, Christian, his sister, Hella, and I, and then the other couple stayed in another apartment. And we found some food and made some food. And the next day, Christian said, "Well, we're not going to have enough to live forever here. I better go out," he said, "and look for another place where I can get food." And I said, "Christian, it's not safe. You're a young man. You are supposed to be in uniform, you know. What are people going to say all of a sudden?" "Oh," he said, "I'll do all right." And we waited and waited and waited for him. And all of a sudden, here was Mr. Anders with Christian. And he stood there, and the first thing, he looked at me with a fierce look. And he said, "And you, Dittmann," he said, "what are you doing here?" And quickly, Hella and I said, "Oh, Mr. Anders, are we ever glad to see you? Because we got separated somehow, and we didn't know how we're going to make it back, and where would we find you? Are we ever glad?" It was a lie. But you know, it either was that or the firing squad. We're recaptured. And so then we went back, and then we walked, and we walked, and we walked, and we were getting so tired. And all of a sudden, there was a deserted farm, and there was a little kitty cart, a little wagon. "Why don't we go there and pick up the wagon and put our knapsacks and our suitcase on there?" I went there and brought it back. And at that moment, Mr. Anders, who had been walking in the front of the whole of us, he saw me, and he came with full blast and grabbed me, took his revolver, held it against my chest, and he says, "One more word out of you, little brat, or I'll shoot." And I just looked at him. He dragged me a few yards and then dropped me and let me go. But boy, it was scary. And then they moved us to a final destination, and that was the city of Grünberg, and that's where we stayed for a long time. And I remember we were marching on icy roads, and my shoes wore out. And I was issued a pair of wooden shoes with a wooden sole and rough top, kind of like a low boot, you know. And evidently I had a lot of dirt on me, and a blister formed. And I rubbed that blister, and I could feel funny, like I had a fever, a blood poisoning. And my foot had turned color, but I could not let go, because people, where they think they're sick, they aren't good for working, they're going to be either shot on the spot or clubbed to death. So I kept on day after day walking, tried not to limp. The only person that knew anything about it was my friend Hella, because there were people among us and our own that would squeal. We had noticed that there was a strange noise in the distance. Yeah. And that night, the sky, the horizon was lit up bright red, and there was a strange smell, vibration beneath us, and the farmers were running with their livestock to get away from Grünberg, running with their livestock, with their wagons, horse wagons, loaded way up high with their belongings. And we thought, what is going on? And so somebody stepped out of line, I don't know who it was, And of course, it was pitch dark, and the leaders were anxious to get us into our quarters. And so we stepped out, and the farmer said, "The Russians are coming. They'll be here in the morning." And so, of course, our Nazi leaders took us to our women's quarters. We were locked up. The men were across the street in their quarters, evidently locked up, and nobody could escape that night. And there were five of us girls that were very close. We had a close bond, and it was Christian's sister, and then Hella and I, and we prayed at night that the Lord will be merciful, and if it is His will, that He would free us from our persecutors. Well, we knew it took a mighty miracle. So early in the morning, we got the shouts of the leaders, get up, everybody get up, form a line. And there were horse-drawn wagons, and they were chauffeured by Polish prisoners of war that worked as slaves on German farms. And I was so glad. I could hardly get up on that wagon, so people helped me up. And my leg was more swollen. I felt more feverish. And I was just glad. But where are they taking us? The men were lined up on the opposite side of the street. Before we got on the wagons, they said, "If anybody of you have boyfriends or husbands, you can say goodbye." So the guys came over, and Christian said goodbye to me and said goodbye. And Christian couldn't say anything. He just held my hand, and then they went. And heartbreaking, very heartbreaking, especially when I said goodbye to Christian. It was heartbreaking. But my friend Uschi Müller left her husband behind. She collapsed in the wagon and wept bitterly, so that got me off my sorrow over Christian to comfort her. And Hella and I sat next to Uschi, and we tried to comfort her, and we were whisked off. And it was a long, cold ride. But on the way, we saw a railroad station. But we went past that. Very soon, in the dark yet, we saw a complex of barracks and a smokestack and barbed wire fence around it. So we knew there was a camp waiting for us. And there was nobody there. It was deserted somehow. And as the guards were conferring, we needed keys to get into the barracks and kerosene lamps. And while they conferred with each, the guard conferred with each other and had their backs turned, three of the girls, Hella and I, were staying behind because I couldn't walk anymore, and she wouldn't leave me. So these girls escaped through a deep forest while they were not seen. And sure enough, the guards came back and they said, "I need two volunteers to go with this Polish prisoner of war to get the key for the barracks and the kerosene lamps." "Oh," Hella said, "we'll go." And so we crawled on the wagon, and this fellow, this Polish prisoner, whisked us off. And so I had some money, and Hella had some cigarettes, and we gave it to this Polish prisoner of war, and he said, "Hurry, hurry, please get us to the railroad station." And he did. And we were far gone. Then when we got to the railroad station, the other three girls had just arrived too. We saw tanks, army tanks, on flatbeds. And then there was a blonde, tall, handsome soldier standing there, blonde, tall, blue eyed. The girl said, "You look the most Aryan, why don't you go talk to him?" And he gave me a big smile, and I said, "Hi, sir." I said, "My name is Anita." And he said, "My name is Valdemar. What can I do for you?" "Those girls over there and I, we gotta get away from the Russians. I know that they are very, very close. The farmers told us that." "Yeah," he said, "we're just about ready to leave." And I said, "What kind of tanks?" "Oh," he said, "they are slightly demolished Russian tanks, and we're taking it to Fürstenwalde near Berlin. And we are going to stop, and they will be repaired to be reused." And he got the permission from his CO, and he said, the CO said, "Well, you guys, if you want to share your food rations with these girls, go ahead." We climbed in the tank, and pretty soon the whistle blew, and the thing took off. There were five girls and two soldiers. But he was a marvelous guy. He was so decent. I slept on his shoulder all night long with his arm around me. We made a stopover, and it was morning. And all of us had to go to the bathroom too, and I couldn't walk anymore. So Valdemar picked me up out of the tank, carried me, and he gave me a toothbrush and some toothpaste and some soap and a towel. And the other guy, this Klaus, that was taking a shine to Hella, did the same thing, and we went into the bathroom and we giggled in there because everything seemed so funny all of a sudden. You know, humor takes over, it's better than fear. Finally, we went back into the tanks and we drove off to Fürstenwalde, where the tanks would be repaired. Then we parted with the soldiers, but before we parted, Valdemar gave me his army address. He said, I was hoping our friendship would last longer, so let's stay in touch, and here you can get a hold of me.
If you just joined me, I am playing a portion of the Anita Dittmann Holocaust survival story. Very uplifting experience. I was privileged to put into book form some years ago, also made into a DVD. Here is Anita to wrap up today's hour.
Valdemar had told me before he released me, you must go someplace and get some help. And so I quickly went to a Red Cross station, and they cut the whole blister off, which was very wrong, and put the big blister and the fluid came out, and then they put some disinfectant powder on, gave me a Band-Aid, and off I went into the next train. An SS man sat beside me. I fell asleep on his shoulder. And when I woke up, I was horror-struck, and I looked at Hella and Uschi, and I thought, oh my gosh, and the guy smiled at me, big smile. He said, oh, if you knew who was sleeping on your shoulder. Well, then finally, we got to Arnsbach, which was outside of Dresden, and there was a siren howling, and we were going to have to get out of the train into the air raid shelters. I couldn't walk anymore. I mean, the girls went down, we'll carry you down. I said, go down, I stay outside. And I watched the horrible spectacle of that firestorm in Dresden. It was terrible. I had bombs in all shapes and forms. Some of them came down like burning Christmas trees. It was just a fireworks. I mean, it was terrible. And it was so close that they came down where I was standing, out on the street, out on the open. Yeah, a bomb could have gone astray, but I didn't think that way. You have to keep a positive attitude and trust the Lord. And if the Lord wants to take you home, he'll take you home, and the bomb will fall on top of me, you know? That's the way you have to be. I stood out there, and when the siren howled, when the flames were gone, it was horrible what I saw the next day. They made a makeshift Red Cross station out of part of that little railroad station, and oh, this is awful. But when the girls come up, they were amazed. I was just standing there, you know, and we were afraid you might have gotten a bomb on you. I said, no, I guess I'm not ready yet to go home to God. So this is okay, I'm okay. And I walked to the nearest city of Usch. It's a little mountain town. And I don't know, it's just amazing how the Lord kept me walking. And I thought, I'm going to go to the hospital. I have to have that leg checked because it was very swollen. And so was my foot. So I went to a Catholic hospital that was run by nuns, and they were so nice. They said, we'll take care of you. And I stayed there almost a week. The war was over then, and ultimately I got to a place in Czechoslovakia, and I spoke in English. And when they heard me, he looked at me, you know, and then when I spoke in English, the guy, that Czech soldier, and I said, where is the American government here? Oh, they're in that big tent over there. So I went over there and waited. They said, there is a jeep going to Pilsen where I would find a contact person. The guy that sat next to me was putting his arm around me and was very friendly. And I said, Lord, what are they trying to do? Show me. God gave me a splendid idea. I pretended I didn't understand English. And that's how I found out what they were going to do. They were all five of them going to take me to a barrack in the forest. And then they would help themselves to me, all five of them. I prayed, I said, Lord, help me. And so this guy was talking to me, sweetie, and I just sat like this, and he said, you speak English? Mm-mm. No, no, no speak English. And I pretended. And he got so frustrated. I said, Lord, please help me to get out of here. And the guy got so frustrated that he told the driver to stop. And he picked me up. And in great anger, he set me down and drove off. And so I went out of the forest. And there I had to cross a bridge. And when I started walking toward the bridge, and I was still limping a little, and there were two American soldiers on the other side of the bridge. And they were waving to me, and I said, oh, God, no. And one of them came over, and he said, can I help you? I said, yeah, can you help me find this address? How did you get here? And I told him, and I told him what happened. I don't know whether it sounded funny. My English wasn't maybe there, but he started giggling. I said, it was not funny. He said, yeah, we'll help you. And then he called the other one and said, we are Jewish and we will help you and we don't want anything in return. So they walked with me a long, long way through the whole city of Pilsen to the people's address where I was supposed to be staying overnight. I stayed with the sentinels for a little bit of the night. They put me up and then it was still dark outside. They took me to the train and then it was the last stretch on the train. And I thought, well, I will be very quiet and I won't talk to anybody. And all of a sudden, I was looking out the window and found a man's hand on my shoulder and talking to me in a language I presumed to be Czech. It was a young man with big brown eyes and curly hair. And he asked me, in Niemetz, it means German. And I found out later it was not a very complimentary term. And he said, Deutsch, he said to me in German. And I said, no, Jewish. Oh, Jewish. And he hugged me. I am a Jew too. I will walk with you. And I kind of conveyed to him in English and German. He understood a little of both. And he said, I will walk with you. I will speak for you. I'm going to Prague. And Theresienstadt is not that far. And I'll to get you on a right track so that you can go find your mother and hope you will find her. And he gave me 100 crowns, money. He said, if you need money. And I backed off. He said, I don't want anything from you. I just want to help you. And then he came with me for a little ways to Leitmeritz, and the train stopped there. And then he had to go. And he handed me over to a Czech policeman, gave him money to take me to my mother's camp after he introduced me to this Czech police officer with a jeep. And I wanted to thank him, and he was gone, like blown out of sight. So then I turned to my new escort, and I said, I think God sent me another angel. And he, in good German, too, a lot of the Czechs spoke German. He said, I hope that the same God that sent you angels has kept your mother alive. And then he told me the horrors of Theresienstadt and how very few people have survived. Man with the jeep, and we got to Theresienstadt. I looked at the horrible brick walls that surrounded it, and the gates, big heavy iron gates, were patrolled by a Russian police. And they had orders not to let anybody in because there had been a typhoid epidemic. After this guy conferred with them, he then turned to me and spoke in English, and he said, I told him you have come this far to look for your mother, and she's been in there for many months, and 18 months, and please let her in. And so they did. Theresienstadt was a city. It was a city, oh goodness, how many thousands, big, pretty big city. But then when they crowded everybody in there, it doubled and tripled. And it was terrible. It was awful what the Nazis did there too. In fact, it was a transit camp where people stopped over in order to be sent to Auschwitz. And when I walked in there, boy, I became a coward. I had such fears to walk in, what I might find. But then God gave me a prayer for strength to whatever happens. I said, just give me strength to accept what can't be changed. And Lord, I hope she is alive. I hope you kept her alive. And if not, she is with you, and I shall be content. But I was wishing she would live, or I wouldn't have gone. And I didn't pay any attention to anything inside the building. I just walked right in there, and that's where the lady was. And she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm looking for Hilda Dittmann. I'm her daughter, Anita." And then when this lady said, "Well, you know, I can't find her in the survivor's files," my tears started coming, and she said, "Don't despair, little girl," she said. "I will go in the other room." And she said, "Sit down, it might take a while." And by I tell you, the while seemed endlessly. And I thought, "Oh God, I just hope you've kept her alive." But I tell you, it was unbelievable though. What awful stress. I tried not to have stress, but it happened, you know. This was the last minute. And will she or isn't she? And she came out with a smile. She said, "Hilda Dittmann has survived. She's well, and I'll give you directions on how to get there." I just shrieked with delight. I gave a hug to the lady. This lady told me that that very morning when I came in the early afternoon, my mother had a chance to go home to Breslau, to my hometown, with some friends and other people, and she refused to go. And she said, "If my daughter will come here," she said, "and if she has to crawl with her faith and her determination, and even if she has to crawl," she didn't realize there were sometimes times when I had to change trains, that I had to crawl on my hands and knees to get to the next tracks. She gave me how to get there. And it was quite a ways because it's a big city. And I came to the house there, and the lady came down and she said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Anita." "Oh, Hilda's daughter. She's told us so much about you. Come on, I'll take you upstairs." And so we went that kind of a staircase. And there was my mother sitting on her bed with the pink bathrobe that I had brought her that time, so I knew she got it. But I wasn't weeping then, neither was she. We were so stunned. We had been without a word for over 11 months. And when we first got together and looked at each other, I mean, we couldn't talk. It was so awesome. It was kind of an afternoon, early afternoon on the 7th of June. And then we sat there. And she said, "How did you get here?" And interesting, all the people there sitting with her were Jewish people and did not believe in Christianity. And I talked about Christ a lot and what he did for me, and they were all listening. And interesting enough, that date, exactly a year later, we sailed for America. Night before we were supposed to be docking in Ellis Island, and some of us young people stayed overnight. We took blankets and we stayed overnight on the top deck, and it was a foggy night, and the foghorn blew every 5 minutes and nobody slept, but we didn't mind. We wanted to be the first ones to see the Statue of Liberty. But the crew has alerted the people down below if they want to see the Statue of Liberty. Everybody was on deck. And I tell you, it was so awesome. There was not a dry eye. We wept with gratitude, relief that we had dreams of this, and 13 years passed before the dream was fulfilled. And to see that beautiful lady, every time I look at it, I have a picture of her in my living room. And every time we looked at it, and when I look at it now, it was so awesome, finally. And to read the words on it, it was so outstanding. It was unbelievable. It was like a dream.
This has just been a portion of the Anita Dittmann story from the book. Trapped in Hitler's Hell, a young Jewish woman discovers the Messiah's faithfulness in the midst of the Holocaust. We also have that in DVD form in my online store, and we often hear the saying, "Never again is now." In other words, the intense hatred of the Jewish people that was evidenced in the 1930s and 1940s is present again today as we head into 2025. How is that possible? Because hatred of the Jewish people is the world's oldest and most intense hatred, and it is even embraced by some Christians. As someone penned years ago, and think about this, how odd of God to choose the Jews, but not so odd as those who choose the Jewish God but spurn the Jews. Remember, the enemy thinks that if he can defeat the Jews, he can stop the plan of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, from returning. Israel remains the key to our present and our future, and that is why the world has tried to wipe out the very memory of their existence, but they will always fail. I want to thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.
Contact us through our website, olivetreeviews.org. That's olivetreeviews.org. Call us Central Time at 763-559-4444. That's 763-559-4444. You get our mail when you write to Olive Tree Ministries and Jan Markell, Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota, 55311. That's Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota, 55311. All gifts are tax deductible. Jesus came the first time, but the Bible says he is coming again. He's coming in the rapture of believers and in his glorious return, the second coming. In the meantime, God is allowing all things to happen so we can watch them fall into place.